Okay, thank you, Dr. Taillefer. We'll move ahead now with the next portion of the program. I'd like to introduce Donna Polk, who you've met. She is currently the Director of Preventive Cardiology at Hartford Hospital and the co-director with me in this course. I would also remind you that this would be a good time to jot down questions for Dr. Taillefer that we could cover in the question and answer period, which it looks like we'll be able to start a few minutes earlier this afternoon. So I'd like to turn the program over now to Donna, who will talk to you about stress testing protocols and image interpretation.
Thanks. Okay, this is a talk that most of you will be familiar with. You guys all do stress testing and protocols, but it's a good opportunity to take what Dr. Taillefer said about the radiopharmaceuticals and put that in the context of the protocols that we use so that we can maximize our images and to really think about what each of those agents do and how we can best image our patients and get the most information. So we'll go through some stress testing. We'll look at exercise and pharmacologic, just to remind you about the contraindications and then the effects of medications. Go through the protocols and then just briefly through image interpretation, because you'll be asked to do those interpretations on the exam. For those of you who are recertifying, it's now on the computer. There'll be rotating images. You have the ability to change the color on some of them. She'll be able to use thermal, cool, and gray. Some of the images will just be in gray. So if you don't read in gray, it'll be a good opportunity in the next month or two to spend a little time reminding yourself what things look like in gray. So in order to optimize what information we get from perfusion imaging, we need to think about both the radionuclide, what you just heard about, as well as the stressor and how we can kind of capitalize on each of those to get our best images. And this is basic physiology that you know, but important for us to think about when you, the mouse to work here, when you think about flow rates and we think about exercise as well as pharmacologic stress tests and how we get that hyperemic state, we think about what that flow looks like at rest here and then with the hyperemic state. Here's the percent stenosis by diameter. And through autoregulation, your body does a very good job up until the point where you get about an 80 to 90% stenosis, and then you get resting ischemia. But if you think about when we push the heart, when we get that hyperemic, either through exercise or pharmacologic stress, that drop-off starts at about 50%. We start thinking about seeing reductions in imaging that we're able to see somewhere here. So remember that it depends on how we stress that person when we're able to start identifying that limitation in flow. It's important to remember what that ischemic cascade looks like. We often think of angina as how we look and try to identify ischemia, but it's really the last thing in that cascade. It starts off with flow disparity, diastolic dysfunction, systolic dysfunction, ST depression, and then angina. So when you start thinking, our ability to detect that ischemia is very good when we start looking at flow disparities very early on. So as you know, and important to remember, ever given the choice, always pick exercise as your modality. We get a lot of information from that. It may be quicker and easier for you to get somebody through, but just know that exercise should always be your default stress test. We can look at their functional capacity, symptoms, what their blood pressure does, what their EKG response is, and a lot of information. Importantly, we get functional capacity. Something that we can't get. It's one of the things that limits us in PET and limits us with pharmacologic therapy. Here's a study done by Martha Gulati who looked at survival in women and what their functional capacity was, and it was over a 20-year span. Those patients that couldn't get out of stage one of a Bruce protocol had a much worse prognosis, irrespective of coronary disease, just their functional capacity. So knowing that, being able to provide that information to our patients and to the referring physician is very important. So exercise is always the default if your patient's able to exercise. It's also important to know how much they can exercise. Is it good enough? They can't quite get to 85%. They stop at 78. Is that good enough? It's probably not good enough. This is out of Dr. Heller's lab that he did in the early 90s, looking at what percentage of people had evidence of ischemia on their MPI, their ECG, and whether or not they had angina. And the green is at 85%. And here in the white, it's 70%. You lose a lot by not getting people to their peak. So if you get a test question that asks you and that patient's at 81%, and you have to calculate that out, it's not good enough, okay? It's non-diagnostic. Remember, just keep an eye out for these on the exam questions, what those contraindications. Obviously, unstable angina or decompensated CHF. But remember, too, uncontrolled hypertension, a very recent MI, severe pulmonary hypertension, or somebody who's got severe AS or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So those people, and many of those people that don't have a contraindication to stressing at all, we would then do pharmacologic stress, dipyridamole, adenosine, as well as dobutamine. And those indications, again, patients unable to exercise, an orthopedic limitation, something that they can't exercise, or a contraindication. They have a AAA, they have a severe aortic stenosis. Those patients are left bundled. Dr. DePuy talked to you about the potential artifacts that come from a left bundle. And certain medications, and then post-MI patients. Contraindications to remember: severe asthma, COPD, hypotension, severe bradycardia, caffeine within the last 24 hours or any source of xanthines, and then a high degree of AV block, all right, or sick sinus syndrome, and a very recent MI. Contraindications to doing that pharmacologic stress test with either dipyridamole or adenosine. So what happens when we give pharmaceutical stress tests? Here at baseline, you can see flow based on these arrows, and this is at rest. Here's your coronary stenosis, and here's what we see in the myocardium that it's supplied. Same 4 arrows here, same 4 arrows here. Through collaterals, through autoregulation, you're able to maintain that. When we ask for that response to a vasodilator, we get that hyperemic response. You can see you doubled the flow during the normal coronaries. You can't accommodate that in the stenotic area. So therefore, you don't get that same increase in flow, and therefore the relative difference. Okay, that's all we're doing with vasodilators for pharmacologic stress. What are the differences that we see in the coronary blood flows? At baseline here, with exercise, you can see it increases, dobutamine it increases, but we get 3 to 5 times the increase in coronary flow when we give dipyridamole or adenosine. Sounds great. We should be able to see a lot more. We should be able to have a lot more uptake. But as you heard from Dr. Taillefer, there's that roll-off phenomenon. There's only so much you can extract. You can't take out more. There's a great analogy that Dr. Bergman always describes. How many of you guys remember I Love Lucy? Okay. So do you remember the chocolate factory one? Right? You remember the chocolate factory where she kind of kept up with the slow thing, right? And it went really fast and she couldn't keep up? Right? That's the roll-off phenomenon. You get to a point where you just can't keep up, right? It doesn't matter how many chocolates go by, you can't keep up. All right, so how many of you guys use dipyridamole? Okay, so still some people that use dipyridamole. So as you know, you give that injection over 4 minutes. The peak hyperemic phase happens at about 4.5 minutes, plus or minus about 100 seconds. So we wait to give that isotope till about 8 minutes. So we make sure that we've caught that hyperemic phase, and then image later on. Okay, remember imaging earlier with thallium, because of the redistribution. You can image a little bit earlier if that patient's walking, usually at about 60 minutes if they haven't had any walking. Adenosine, as you guys know, works as a coronary vasodilator. activates that cellular adenosine receptor at the A2 receptor on that smooth muscle cell, causes that vasodilatation and that hyperemic response. Again, 4 to 5 times that baseline blood flow in a very, very short half-life as opposed to dipyridamole. If we think about this as extracellular space here, this is intracellular space here, and it works at this adenosine receptor site, doesn't have the greatest affinity for it, so it's easily bumped off by things like caffeine or theophylline, so we tend to avoid these prior to stress testing. Can also come in a facilitated transport intracellularly, but we really start thinking about this A2 receptor as the site for where it works. What happens when we give adenosine? You guys know you look for this as a response. That blood pressure drops a little bit, heart rate goes up, diastolic blood pressure goes down. We in fact know that patients are getting it as we sort of see that response. So that infusion goes, because of its short half-life, need to continue that infusion, give them the radiopharmaceutical halfway through, and continue that adenosine so that you can maintain that hyperemia. And then imaging afterwards. Important to know the times to discontinue it. If there's greater than a 2 millimeter ST depression, bronchospasm, severe hypotension, or persistent symptomatic high degree AV block, so complete R block or second degree AV block that's persistent and symptomatic. What about ST depressions with adenosine? Does it matter? It actually has a high positive predictive value if it's there, so it's important to pay attention to it. Put it in the context of that patient when you're doing their report. As you know, lots of side effects, both with adenosine and dipyridamole. It's not as though adenosine has less side effects. They're just quicker, more short-lived. And most of those are reversed with aminophylline. So many protocols will just automatically give aminophylline to reverse those. But know that they're frequent, and patients often have several of those side effects. If you exercise patients at the same time, just a low-level exercise, you reduce those symptoms significantly. These are patients who had adenosine only versus adenosine with exercise. So in whole, most of them had less severe symptoms when they're exercising. So the goal is to try to find a more specific A2 receptor. Something that has less side effects, doesn't affect other receptors, including bronchospasm. Could we give these in patients who have bronchospastic asthma, COPD, things like that? And as you know, how many of you guys use regadenoson? Okay, so those of you who aren't, we just bypassed adenosine, right? Either using dipyridamole or using regadenoson. As you know, very short half-life, and it's not without side effects. Patients getting regadenoson still get side effects, right? They may be less in intensity, but they do. Because it'll wrap an infusion, get a flush, and that trace is injected 30 seconds later. So a very, very quick protocol. What about dobutamine? We all try to avoid it, right? Because patients are often very symptomatic. Patients who can exercise and have contraindications to adenosine, regadenoson, dipyridamole. Contraindications, again, very similar to what we think about for exercise. Unstable angina, recent MI, hypotension, or severe hypertension. Tachyarrhythmias, AS, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or large aortic aneurysm. Similar things that you think about when you think about exercising someone. Because those side effects are very similar, or the effects of it are very similar to what we see in patients who exercise. Systolic blood pressure goes up, diastolic down, and the heart rate goes up. Just as you would expect. So you need to think about it as though you're exercising somebody, but those side effects and it lingers much, much longer. So as you know, we give it in a stepwise fashion, 10, 20, 30, 40 milligrams per micrograms per kilogram per minute over time. We can augment that with arm, leg exercises, atropine if necessary, and at peak heart rate at 85% is when you inject that radiopharmaceutical. And again, imaging later. What about the drugs that patients are taking when you're imaging them? It's important to think about why you're getting that stress test. Are you trying to diagnose cardiovascular disease or you're trying to risk assess that patient. So it matters what they're on and whether or not those get discontinued. Here's a nice study looking at patients who were in the size of their defect based on whether or not they were on no cardiac drugs or that they were on cardiac drugs. And here's, in all three territories, a significant difference in the size of the defect if those patients, and these were mostly on calcium channel blockers and on nitrates, you can see a huge difference. And in a classic study by Dr. Taillefer, looking at whether or not patients were on beta blockers, here, placebo, you see there's a very large lateral defect. Patients on low-dose metoprolol, less of a defect. And here on high-dose metoprolol, a very, very small defect, almost normalized. So important to know what patients are on because it affects certainly the size and severity of the defects that we see. Again, if you're looking to see whether or not somebody's appropriately treated on their pharmacologic regimen, leave them on their medications. That's fine. But if you're trying to diagnose coronary disease, they need to be off of medications. Oops, can I go back one? Can I go back one? Please? Can I go back one slide, please? Okay. So if you look at caffeine, and this study sort of suggested that maybe it was okay to have caffeine. In this study, they looked at a very small amount of caffeine in patients, so an 8-ounce cup, right? How many people had 8 ounces of coffee? How many people had more than 8 ounces of coffee today? Yeah, okay. You're in the board prep course. Of course you have more than 8 ounces of coffee. So because, remember that adenosine has a very low affinity for that receptor, you have to be very careful about what's around that receptor. So what's if there's caffeine or xanthines around, so you really want to minimize it. We can't really control what patients eat, how much chocolate they have, how much coffee they have, so we have them not take it. In very, very low doses, it may be okay to have these patients go on and have their stress testing. But you really can't regulate and know how much people's caffeine levels are. So in general, we ask people not to avoid all caffeine. So for cardiac drugs, it's important to know, as I mentioned, why you're having that stress test. If it's to assess therapy, leave them on their drugs. If it's to diagnose it, to coronary disease, have them come off of their drugs. So you need to individualize that. Ask why the stress test is being done. So we'll go briefly through the imaging protocols. Some of you guys will do one type, so it's important to realize the advantages and disadvantages of some that you may not do in your practice. Do one-day dual isotope, two-day technetium, single isotope, and then one-day stress delay, thallium. So what about, does anybody do dual isotope same day? Okay, one or two, all right. So it's a very fast protocol, as I'll show you on the next slide. You have thallium on board, so you have that for viability. And there's some good prognostic data for it. More difficult thing is, how do you assess some of those prognostic factors, such as TID? I mean, you've got thallium, not as nice, crisp, a little bit different cavity size, and technetium, and you're trying to compare those. So it takes some practice to do that. Looking at whether a fixed or versus a partially reversible defect, whether it's attenuation or coronary disease, a little bit harder. And then if you're assessing for viability, you still have to wait 4 hours later. So it's not as fast in that sense. So at baseline, you give that thallium, okay? Then exercise, give your technetium agent at peak exercise, and then image both agents. Seems like a pretty quick, pretty good protocol, but be aware of the limitations of it. When we talk about the agents, this is where that peak technetium photopeak is, right? You're thinking 140 kV, that's what I should be seeing. But that's not the only place that we see technetium energy. We also see it down here, right where the thallium is, okay? You can't tell what that energy is coming from. You're just counting energy, okay? You don't know whether it's from the thallium or whether it's the technetium. So you may not be able to assess this very accurately if you look at them dually. So know the limitations if you're looking at them simultaneously. So what about the same-day protocol for single isotope? The advantages are that it's very well validated. There's lots of good information. You can get people through pretty quickly. It's the same isotope, so you're not trying to figure out how do I figure out TID, how do I look at that. It makes it a little bit easier. You can, there's validated attenuation correction for it. The problem is if you're doing it the same day, one of the doses, either the rest or stress, how you decide to do it, is going to be of lesser quality. It's going to be a lower dose, so lower quality image. If you start with low dose rest and do a high dose stress, then you have to do both. If you do a low dose stress and a high dose rest, then the image that you really care about, the stress, is going to have the lower counts. So you sort of, it's always kind of a trade-off for that. So if you think about that, here's the rest, okay, so this is a low-dose rest followed by imaging, and then you wait 3 hours, stress, through high dose, okay? Many practices do this routinely, and you can kind of get efficient at getting patients through this. But it takes the whole day. You have to wait this time in between. If you then, again, do exercise first, look at it's the lower dose, all right? You're using the low dose for your stress images. So you lose some of that quality. And that rest images done later are okay, or are higher dose. What about just splitting it into 2 days? Okay, why not just get 2 images on 2 days? Some of the advantages are you get great images on both. Right, you can gate both the rest and the stress because you've got a lot of photons that you can count. If you do the stress first and it's normal, you don't need to come back for the next day to do the rest. It obviates having to come back for a rest stress. You can do that stress only, use other modalities such as prone or attenuation correction to help figure out whether there are artifacts. The disadvantages are that if you do need to bring somebody back, it's 2 days. It's inconvenient for the patients, particularly patients that live at far distances. And then you have to look at it, make a decision, and then bring the patient back and read it again. So it makes it a little bit more cumbersome for the reader. This is what that looks like. Done on day one, you wait 24 hours, done on day two. So stress first, rest second. Again, if you do the stress and it's totally normal, you don't need a rest. What about thallium? During the shortage, many of us looked at a lot of thallium scans, and here's what you're really doing is you perform the stress test, inject that thallium, and remember, you have to do that soon. Look within that 15 minutes, do your imaging, wait 3 to 4 hours to get your rest, which is really a redistribution, right? It's not truly a rest, it's a redistribution images as part of a stress protocol. You heard a little bit, Dr. Dribala talked about viability. Just to show you kind of schematically what that looks like, the injection at rest, get rest images, wait 3 to 4 hours, and you can get that redistribution image. You can also do it 24 hours later to look really delayed for viability. So each of the protocols has advantages and disadvantages, and you need to sort of think about it. And you'll get questions that you'll say, maybe it's not what I do in my practice, but maybe this patient is 450 pounds. Maybe I need to do a 2-day stress test. Maybe I don't do that normally every day, but for those best images, that might be the best for this patient. And then quality control from patient preparation and acquisition, making sure you know what drugs they're on, what drugs have been removed, if they've had caffeine, to really get the best data. So I'm just going to spend the last couple of minutes going through interpretation. This is something you guys do every day, but it's important to just kind of know what the, if you don't read quantitatively or semi-quantitatively, you may see some of those numbers and just so that you're familiar with them. So always, always read the raw data first. It's important to look at the raw data so that you can anticipate what happens. Dr. Heller showed you a PET scan where if you hadn't looked at the CT attenuation images, you wouldn't have been, you would have called it ischemic. So always important to look at the raw data. Then look at the images that haven't been manipulated or changed in any way with AC or some other modality first, and then one step at a time. If you have stress, then look at stress with AC, and then look at stress and stress AC, and then stress AC rest. So take one step at a time. Don't make two huge steps in order to systematically look at data to see if it follows. Compare the non-prone with the prone if you guys do prone imaging. Non-AC to AC, so make sure you're just comparing the same thing one step at a time. Quantitation, so however you decide to do it, if you decide to do it descriptively or with numbers, just be consistent and make sure your lab is consistent. Then look at the EKG and the SPECT data, draw a conclusion, and then and only then look at the clinical data and give your final conclusion. So important, always look at the raw data for other things. Look at patient motion. This is your chance to say, what artifact am I going to see? What do I need to keep my eyes open for? Look for lung uptake, particularly if you're using thallium. Count density, make sure that it's adequate. It's not all on the arm. Attenuation, look for those potential artifacts, and then always look for extra cardiac activity. So have you guys peek at this? It's kind of running a little slow. Okay. So here's images. He's a 38-year-old gentleman with typical anginal symptoms, a non-diagnostic EKG, and he was actually injected during his episode of chest pain. So pretty messy, right? Hard to look at. What did the raw images look like? Looked like he got up and got a cup of coffee and came back, right? It was all over the place. Okay, so motion corrected. Same patient, motion corrected. So if you're aware of what the potential problems are, you look for the potential solutions. So this was totally normal, but you had to recognize that in the raw images that there was a lot of motion. So when you're looking at the spec, make sure that you confirm what orientation you're at, align the slices, make sure they're normalized. Dr. DePuy talked to you last night about how to make sure that you normalize one set of images or the other. Don't over-normalize it because you can potentially wipe out defects, but to be aware of that, look at the cavity size, look at the relative perfusion, always look at the RV. It's your chance to look at the RV. And then if you see something, make sure you look in another projection. Make sure it's there somewhere else. Determine what you think the severity and extent are, and then decide if there are high-risk features to it. There's TID or multivessel distribution. This is how you will see all the images laid out. You'll see them from apex to base here, septal to lateral, inferior to superior. So all the images that you'll see will look like this. Go to the CBNC website. There'll be some examples. Spend a little time there going through what they have for examples. So you need to make sure that you describe the location, the size, severity, the degree of reversibility, and the number of defects if it's multivessel disease. So it's important to be consistent so that from reader to reader and from place to place and scan to scan that we're consistent. If you don't use the 17-segment model, make yourself familiar with it. If you're used to describing it by the lateral wall or the inferior wall, make sure you're aware of this. It's right on the ASNIC website on the guidelines. And you need to know sort of where those territories are, what numbers are ascribed to which locations, and then which vessels go to which regions. You may get a question, a very simple question that says, you know, this area is usually ascribed to which vessel. Maybe as simple as that. Just make sure you're aware of it if you don't use the 17-segment model normally. When you talk about the extent and severity, all right, well, some people will describe it in whether or not there's mild decrease in counts, whether there's wall thinning, whether it's severe, basically that there are no counts, it's almost like background activity. But be aware if you don't use this semi-quantitatively, these numbers, what that means. The normal fusion is 0, absent is 4, and in between a mild, moderate, and severe reduction. Because that's how we're going to drive the sum stress score. And in, when Dr. Soman talks next and talks about different studies and different things, you may see sum stress score. And if you don't do this semi-quantitatively, it may not be familiar to you. So if you think about if we scored all those 17 segments, our sum stress score, so the total of all of them, gives us the extent and severity of coronary disease. Remember, zero is normal. So if they're all normal, it's zero. But the more the counts are down, the higher the number, the more severe the disease. If you just look at the rest, that equates with what infarction is, the degree of infarction. And if you look at the sum difference, that's the amount of reversibility or ischemia. So be familiar with that if you're not used to using that, because you may see those references. How many of you guys use the polar plot when you read? Okay. So the polar plot, as you know, is against a normal database. All right. It shouldn't be the only thing you read. It could be the final step to sort of clarify, should I make sure I didn't miss something? All right. But it shouldn't be how you read. You shouldn't initially read off a polar plot. It's a supplement. It's sort of maybe you want to double check yourself, but not the primary source. It's also helpful to look at serial studies. Somebody who's had a study 3 or 4 years ago, has that amount of ischemia gotten better or worse? And so it's helpful for that. When you're describing reversibility, it's either partial or complete. It's the same when it's complete reversibility, it comes back to the same as the surrounding myocardium. Usually greater than 2 grade improvement, so from a 3 to a 1, or to improvement of 1, to a score of 1 is considered significant reversibility. Always look at the gating, and important, you'll be able to, on some of the images, change the color. So as Dr. DePuy said, helpful to look at thickening and color. There's usually, I think when I took the exam a couple years ago, it was cool and thermal were your choices. You can see that thickening, okay? And then you can put it in gray to look for wall motion. Look at the EF, sort of help you distinguish whether or not it's ischemic or non-ischemic, and give you an opportunity to look at those gated artifacts. In the same way, if you're not used to quantitating or doing some quantitative analysis of wall motion, be aware of what that wall motion is, dyskinesis being a 5, normal being 1. And 4 being akinesis. So you may see those described in that fashion. So you need to look at both the global and the regional function and answer the question, is it a fixed EVE? Is it coronary disease? Is it an artifact? And then try to think what you think the EF is, what do you think the function is, and then look at the numbers. So try not to rely on those initially. Make your initial assumption, because you're not going to have those on the exam, right? You're going to have to come up with the EF. Look at the RV size and function, and then it gives you a chance to sort of think about whether you think it's a non-ischemic or ischemic cardiomyopathy, if that's what you're evaluating. Make that initial conclusion, and then get the clinical information, utilizing that to give your final conclusion. So if you look at the guidelines on ASNIC, really trying to advocate an abnormal or normal scan, when you take the exam, it's not going to be subtle. Okay, you're not going to sit there and hum and haw all day whether or not you think it's a little tiny something. It'll be there. You'll be able to see it and to read it. In our practice, we should think about really minimizing equivocation. Things should be normal, abnormal, and really very rarely trying to say equivocal, probably normal, or probably abnormal. To describe both the regional and the global function, and then make sure that you note in your thing, if somebody made 82%, you need to describe that, but it may not be exactly the most diagnostic test because you didn't make the full 85%. And then most importantly, answer the clinical question that was asked of you. Are you diagnosing coronary disease? Are you assessing therapy? So it was just kind of a review of what those protocols are, many of which you do in your practice, some of which you might not, but things you need to be aware of as you sit and take the exam, when some of those protocols might be most appropriate, even though that you're not using them in your day-to-day practice. So I thank you for your attention, and we'll go ahead and take a 15-minute break.